Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Michael Rubin makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. As I recall, he was here in 2004 talking about US foreign policy. And tonight the topic is the war on terrorism still necessary? I'll introduce our speaker briefly, but firstly I should say that he's in Australia at the invitation of the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, and we're grateful for Anthony Orkin and others for making this possible tonight. Michael Rubin is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. He also teaches U.S. military personnel before deployment. He is an author and currently completing a book, Dancing with the Devil, on engagement with rogue regimes. But tonight, Michael's going to talk to us on, is the war on terrorism still necessary? Michael Rubin, you're very welcome.
Thank you. Well, certainly it was welcome to wake up one day and hear the news that Osama bin Laden was killed. President Obama, when he gave the speech announcing Osama bin Laden's death, made clear that this wasn't the end of the war on terror. What President Obama said was, Osama bin Laden's death does not mark the end of our effort. We must remain vigilant at home and abroad. That said, as soon as the word came that Osama bin Laden had been killed, many of President Obama's staunchest supporters, both in the media and also in the policy world, made clear that they believed that this was a watershed moment and that it signaled what should be the end of the war on terrorism. Peter Beinart, for example, who's a frequent visitor to Australia, got on CNN that evening and said, succinctly, the war on terrorism is over. Peter Bergen, a former CNN producer who had actually met Osama bin Laden in, I believe, 1998, had argued that killing bin Laden is the end of the war on terror. It's time to move on. Jimmy Carter, of course, has been increasingly predictable. And what he said the next day was, I would hope that this, meaning the death of Osama bin Laden, would expedite our exit. Certainly, not only Democrats in Congress like Mike Honda, who said this is our moment to move on, but also Republicans, such as the former governor of New Mexico, who's actually a candidate for president, more on a libertarian side of the Republican Party, also called for Osama bin Laden's death to signal the end of the war on terrorism. What I would argue, however, is that those who believe that bin Laden's death concludes the war on terrorism misunderstand the ideology which motivates the Islamists and Islamist antipathy to the West. And here we very much have an academic debate in the West. The University of Chicago political scientist Robert Pape has declared succinctly in a series of writing that when it comes to the motivation for terrorism, it is, quote, the occupation stupid, making an allusion to the famous quip during the, the elder President Bush years in which the slogan of Bill Clinton became, it's the economy stupid. What he would argue, and he has certainly conducted a great deal of research and put together quite an impressive database that combines not only incidents of Islamist terrorism and Middle Eastern terrorism, but also terrorism in Sri Lanka with the Tamil Tigers, is that the common variable motivating terrorism is a reaction to occupation. That if you end occupations, the motivation for terrorism ends. Therefore, if you accept Robert Pape's work, you are drawn to the conclusion that if only the U.S. reduced its presence in Afghanistan and Iraq and the Persian Gulf, if only Israel withdrew completely from the West Bank and Gaza, of course they've already withdrawn from the Gaza and that hasn't ended terrorism, but let's put that aside, perhaps even the Galilee as well. If only we didn't have any forces in Libya, then their terrorism would magically end overnight. Again, I disagree with Robert Pape and his argument and the tendency within the political science community to believe that a single variable can explain everything, and certainly that it would trump the issue of ideology. There's other historical reasons before I start describing the ideological roots of Islamist terrorism, which also undercut this notion that terrorism is motivated solely by occupation. In 1946, in the wake of World War II, the Intelligence Division of the War Office, basically the predecessor to the United States Defense Intelligence Agency, was assigned a paper to determine, now that Nazism and fascism have been defeated, what are the looming over the horizon threats that the United States military and the White House should be aware of? And certainly, threat number one was communism. Threat number two, however, in 1946, 2 years before Israel's independence, was the threat of Islamist terrorism. And what the Intelligence Division of the War Office was citing, and the trend which was of most concern to them, was the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Already, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt at that point had tried to assassinate the Prime Minister and had successfully assassinated several other ministers and government officials on the belief that if they weren't properly Islamic in the point of view of the Muslim Brotherhood, that they were fair game to be purged violently. Likewise, one of the reasons why I tend to look at ideology as a defining issue rather than simply occupation would expose itself in what happens in the banlieue of Paris, in the suburban housing projects of Paris, where women have been terrorized by gangs of Islamist youth. And of course, when that occurs, the violence that occurs there in those housing projects and against women has absolutely nothing to do with occupation and everything to do with a somewhat radical brand of ideology. Now, when President Obama spoke in Cairo in his first major address to the Muslim world, he praised multiculturalism. And there is nothing wrong with multiculturalism. However, too often in the Western concept, multiculturalism is about being able to go into a Japanese restaurant and order a mojito to go along with one sushi. Fundamentally, however, we need to recognize that multiculturalism isn't simply about enjoying the best of every culture, but also understanding that different cultures can fundamentally think in very different ways. And one of the worst mistakes any analyst can make is projection, to assume that everyone else in the world thinks like we do and shares the same value system that we do. It's this understanding how other people think and the diversity of thought and the diversity of definitions that is important to understand why the war on terrorism isn't going to be over, no matter what American or, more broadly, Western policy is. Suicide bomb attacks are an outgrowth of contemporary interpretations of Islamic theology. I'm not saying that all Muslims share the same interpretations, nor am I saying that all Muslims are radical. I've been making a very distinct point of discussing Islamism and Islamists in order to signal an attachment to an ideology rather than simply an attachment to a religion. I do want to talk about some concepts and the debate within religion which occurs around those concepts. Today, I find it ironic that when people talk about jihad, too often we hear that it does not mean holy war, that it just means an internal struggle to make oneself a better Muslim. And among many Muslim moderates, perhaps among the majority of the Muslim population, that is true. However, it is absolutely wrong to say that jihad does not mean holy war. On one hand, people will say that in the Quran, it never discusses jihad as holy war. The problem is, in the Hadith, which is an important source of Islamic jurisprudence, the most important source after the Quran, it oftentimes does address jihad, as meaning holy war. One third of a volume of Bukhari's compilation of Hadith, the most important compilation of Hadith, is dedicated solely to jihad as holy war. As important, when we talk about Islamic fundamentalism, the Salafis, the Wahhabis, perhaps the Diobandis as well, oftentimes we have no problem discussing how they want, how their interpretation is shaped by the desire to return Islam to what they believe to be the Golden Age in the classical period and in and around the time of the Prophet Muhammad. Usually when we talk about the classical age of Islam, we're talking in the time period from 750 AD to the Mongols when they sacked Baghdad in 1258 AD. The important thing, however, is not to be anachronistic. When we talk about what the interpretation of jihad is now, we have to recognize that in all religions, interpretation is fluid. It evolves. However, if someone is looking back at the classical period in order to return to that point in time, it is just as important to ask, what was this concept understood to be? Not in the year 2011, but let's say in the year 1215. And in the classical period of Islam, jihad was understood primarily to mean holy war, with this notion of internal struggle a very, very distant alternate meaning. Now, the problem isn't simply jihad as holy war. What I want to do is go through the exegesis, the interpretation of Islam, that colored and in fact deeply influenced the thought of Osama bin Laden. In the 1950s, 60s, and especially in the 1970s, of course, there was an oil boom in Saudi Arabia. This is how the bin Ladens made their fortune, as Osama bin Laden's father was a construction magnate. I've actually been to the bin Laden's compound right outside of Jeddah. I went snorkeling there. Now, in the 1970s, along with this oil boom, one had an influx of, if you will, Western culture. Saudis bought Cadillacs. Women wore makeup. Hawaii 5-0, not the new version, but the original version, was still on the airwaves. And there was a tendency, a trend, if you will, in Sunni jurisprudence coming out of Saudi Arabia, which said that Western culture, that these Cadillacs, lipstick, Western television shows and soap operas aren't just a danger to our youth. They are a deliberate attempt to corrupt our youth and drive our youth away from religion. And therefore, this isn't just an issue of multiculturalism and not enjoying some aspects of another culture. What many theologians in Saudi Arabia in the 1970s suggested was that Western culture, what was on the airwaves, were just as dangerous and just as aggressive an attack on Islam as an F-16 would be over Mecca or Medina. Now, how does this play into Osama bin Laden? There was a Palestinian who left the West Bank, entered Jordan, and eventually got a scholarship, got kicked out of Jordan, got a scholarship to study in Egypt by the name of Abdullah Azam. He was actually kicked out of Jordan for Muslim Brotherhood activities. After he left Egypt and again briefly returned to Jordan, he settled in Saudi Arabia where he was teaching in Jeddah. He was teaching in Jeddah at the same time that Osama bin Laden was a student there, and the two met and knew each other. What Abdullah Azam, who really is Osama bin Laden's theological mentor, preached was not only this issue of the West engaged in a preemptive attack on Islam, but against the backdrop of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, he also argued that jihad, while a defensive war, was absolutely mandatory. And while we might look at terrorism today as offensive in nature, Abdullah Azam preached that it was defensive because the West had already attacked Islam with Hawaii 5-0 and Cadillacs, and that it wasn't an issue for discussion. It wasn't optional. Once one was attacked, it was absolutely mandatory to respond until the aggressor was defeated. Now today, you may hear many professors, academics, and pundits note that, yes, jihad might mean holy war, but it's strictly defensive in nature. But it would be an absolute mistake to assume that our definition of defense is the same as those who are, or our understanding of defense is the same as those who are engaged in the Islamist fight against the West. So while certainly I would look at the attack on the USS Cole in 2000, to which the United States didn't respond, or the attack on 9/11, to which we did respond, or going earlier in time, the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993, to which we did not respond, I would look at all those as surprise attacks on the United States or on U.S. interests. How I would put them in the same category as the Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor. But from the point of view of the Islamist terrorists, the United States started the fight and the West started the fight when we allowed our culture to be directed into the Middle East. Is it possible to compromise on that culture? I would argue absolutely not. Now, I've been mainly talking about the Sunni world. I do want to just point out, as someone who, by training and by my academic career, is more of an Iran watcher. I used to live in Iran. They used to call me Pasadi Shaitani Bozork, son of the great Satan. My PhD is in Iranian history. And I follow the Iranian rhetoric quite regularly. Among the principalist camp, which some people would call the hardliners, but in Iran they say usugarian, return to the principles, you oftentimes hear the phrase cultural NATO. And it certainly doesn't slip off the tongue. But when the Iranians talk about cultural NATO, something which Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is fond of discussing, he's basically accepting a parallel trend of intellectual thought to what Abdullah Azam believed. When he talks about a cultural NATO with women wearing lipstick and so forth, he's accusing the West of being the aggressor and attacking Iran first, not through military means, but by culture. But in reality, there is no difference between the two to those in Iran who are calling the shots, just like there wasn't to Abdullah Azzam and Osama bin Laden. Now I want to break and just go in a slightly different direction as we talk about the future. There's an active debate within al-Qaeda, and there has been since before Osama bin Laden's death, about the future of al-Qaeda. Certainly, Osama bin Laden had gone into hiding, and while I'm sure intelligence analysts are now poring over the documents which they received and seized in order to determine just how much control he had over day-to-day operations, the fact of the matter is, because he didn't want to communicate by cellular telephone, and because the American response and the Australian response in Afghanistan had forced Osama bin Laden to go underground, so to speak, there was an active debate about what the future of al-Qaeda should be, what their strategy should be. And this debate crystallized into two different poles. Abu Musab al-Suri was one of the chief thinkers of al-Qaeda. And what he argued, given the supremacy of the American military and the Western military in general, that al-Qaeda needed to accept a decentralized structure. Instead of having training camps like they had in Afghanistan before 2001, they should operate out of people's houses, maybe out of mobile homes somewhere, and they should always be on the move. Use the internet and electronic communications in order to coordinate, but basically be a loose structure operating under agreed-upon principles. He was contradicted by another ideologue within al-Qaeda, a guy named Abu Bakr Naji, and he argued, no, it's essential to control territory. And Abu Bakr Naji has actually gained the upper hand within al-Qaeda thought, it appears. Certainly, we know that al-Qaeda groups do control some territory. In Yemen, there's a real concern about al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And there's no way that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula would have been able to plan the Christmas Eve, the Christmas Day underwear bomb when they had the Nigerian radical Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalib try to detonate himself and his underwear over Detroit if they hadn't been able to work with him in territory which the government didn't control in Yemen. Likewise, there's the problem of the Times Square of Pakistan and the Times Square attack, which was planned in areas which the Pakistani Taliban controlled. I'm actually increasingly concerned about al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which controls many of the areas of the Sahel, areas of Chad, Niger, Algeria, Mali, Mauritania, and so forth, and as you know, has been active in the kidnapping and sometimes killing of European terrorists. They've also become increasingly active in the drug trade in sub-Saharan Africa all the way down to Mozambique. Somalia is also a safe haven. Now, so it's clear that al-Qaeda does enjoy some safe havens. What al-Qaeda and al-Naji would argue is we can't only use these safe havens to plan terrorism or defense against the West. But we also need to look at these territories to show that we can govern and that we have a philosophy. And therefore, one has a situation where in Somalia, with al-Shabaab, which was the successor to the Islamic Courts Union, or in Pakistan, with the Tehreek-e Taliban Pakistan, there's not only a desire to control territory, but also to impose Islamist concepts or al-Qaeda's vision of government on the local population. I want to bring up the situation of the Malakand Accords and the Swat Valley in February 2009. The Pakistani army had looked at much of the northwest frontier province as ungovernable. They had absolutely no interest in having Pakistanis go and die in some of these areas in which the Pakistani Taliban was seizing greater and greater control. So in February 2009, they made a deal with the Pakistani Taliban to enable the Pakistani Taliban, in effect, to take over government in certain districts. When that happened, when this vacuum was created, what we saw was a doubling in the number of Taliban forces in the Swat Valley. I believe from 3,000 to 6,000. Now remember what the Swat Valley is. It's basically the resort area of Pakistan. It was an area where people were religious, but they weren't religious in the Taliban sense. But suddenly, women could no longer go out without a husband present, or a father, or a son. And you had the worst excesses of the Taliban visited upon this area, which traditionally was much more tolerant. Well, that only lasted 2 months, because in April 2009, the Taliban, which had regrouped all of its forces in these areas which were ceded to them by the Pakistani government, decided to march on another district, Bunair, which was just 60 kilometers from Islamabad. It was at that point in time that the Pakistani army decided to get very heavily involved and fought back the Pakistani Taliban, in the process creating more casualties on both sides than would have occurred had the Pakistani government not ceded the territory in the first place. What I worry about is that while many in the United States are intent, and many in Australia and Europe, following the American lead, are intent for domestic political reasons, for very real economic reasons as well, to basically say we can't continue this war on terrorism forever, what are we really doing in Afghanistan anyway? That if we cede territory, that ultimately it's going to create more bloodshed down the line, as opposed to if we have a strategy to quarantine safe havens and vacuums and to force them to shrink. That does not mean that the Americans or the Australians or the Brits will be in Afghanistan indefinitely. It just means that we need to have a strategy either to enable the Afghan National Army to better control territory quicker or bring in others. For example, perhaps the Indians, who could play a much greater role in effect in their proxy battle with Pakistan. It's not in anyone's interest to have Afghanistan ceded at strategic depth to the worst elements of the Pakistani military and intelligence service. What I would argue now is that we may try to believe that the war on terrorism is over, but because it's not an issue of our troops being there, because the Taliban has gotten worse when we've withdrawn from from Kunar and Nordistan and actually seized districts in these areas, we're in a situation where a premature withdrawal and a premature end to the war on terrorism will actually make the war on terrorism worse. Now, I hope during my talk I've been provocative and you have lots of questions. I will say that one of the drawbacks of working in Washington is that every now and then I'll be sitting at my desk trying to finish a paper or a newspaper article. I'll be under deadline. And that's the time, Murphy's Law suggests, when either Fox News or CNN, or actually on rare occasions MSNBC, will call and say, we need you down at the studio now to talk for 20 seconds about Afghanistan. Of course, when they say you want to talk for 20 seconds on Afghanistan, I have to be down there plenty early because they also say that my forehead shines too much and they need to slather on that stuff. At any rate, I was recently doing this on Fox News and I got back to the green room, to the waiting room, where the next person was up. It was a governor from a southwestern state. I think he's going to be talking about immigration. And he had with him his whole entourage. I don't get an entourage. At any rate, one of the governor's aides looked up, because they had been watching me on television before they themselves were called back to the chair, and said, you know, Michael, we thought you looked good up there. I said, that's kind of funny because my wife just called me and said, Michael, I thought you looked fat, bald, and mean. The governor looked up from his notes and said, nah, I didn't think you looked mean. The point of this is, now that my speech has concluded, no matter how mean I might look, feel free to ask me any questions. I believe we have about a half hour.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. So, thanks to Michael Rubin. So we've got plenty of time. You're right on time. As you know, the United States and Australia and the other allies went into Afghanistan primarily to stop the Taliban administration making it possible for al-Qaeda to train there. As you also know, come the next election in the United States, there'll be more U.S. troops in Afghanistan than there were when President Obama was elected. But in view of that, I mean, how do you see the recent decision of the Premier to effectively bring back the surge numbers? Do you think that's going to have a major impact or little impact, or is it somewhere in the middle?
My major criticism of President Obama and his decision is with his reliance on timelines, which are more political than anything else. We have to understand that the surge in military action is just as much psychological as it is military. And when one has a situation where one discusses a timeline, it simply encourages Afghans to make accommodation with the other side, to back the strong horse. Afghans, remember, have never lost a war. They just defect to the winning side. Now, certainly you're absolutely correct that we will have had a surge, and then we will bring the troops back to a pre-surge level, which will still be higher than what it was when George W. Bush was president. But what I worry about is, in this part of the world, perception is more important than reality, and I worry about a sense that momentum is not on our side. Yesterday, Alexander Downer was on television. Alexander Downer was on television and said that he didn't disagree with the idea of bringing troops home. But he disagreed with President Obama's timing, that the time for diplomacy would be when we were augmenting troops into the theater, not when we were withdrawing troops, because the Taliban will convince themselves that in such a case, they are stronger and we are weaker.
Thanks for that, Mr. Downer and Mr. Rubin. We're on Sky News Agenda yesterday on Sky News at 8:30 in the morning and repeat it later on. Okay, so right down the back, yeah.
Michael, I wonder what you think would be an effective increase in food shortages if across the world, Africa, and the Middle East, and in Pakistan in particular.
Question about the impact of food shortages on in North America, North Africa, the Middle East, and also in Pakistan on the radicalization of al-Qaeda.
Let me say definitively that I think food shortages are bad. That said, what I want to do is focus on what I actually see along the theme of your question as perhaps the greater problem. Certainly when we look across the region, we've seen a great deal of popular unrest. The so-called Arab Spring, which of course is also extended into Iraqi Kurdistan, into Iran, and into other areas. What I worry about is this, leading to further radicalization. The economies in all of these countries have actually been growing. It's not economic stagnation which has caused the revolutions. It's unfulfilled expectations and government corruption. One of the reasons why, and most revolutions occur when the economy is actually getting better. It certainly was the case with the Islamic Revolution in Iran. What I worry about is over the last 10 years or so, there has been a push for free market reforms, part and parcel of which has been privatization. And this is what sparked the economic growth. The problem is, what did privatization mean in the context, for example, of Egypt? It meant that Hosni Mubarak would take a state-owned industry and give it to Gamal Mubarak to sell off. And in effect, what this has led to is and there's poll numbers to support this, 90% of Egyptians believe that privatization is a bad thing, that it's a sign of the corruption of the old regime. And furthermore, they believe that the government should guarantee everyone a job, the government should guarantee everyone housing, the government should set all salaries, and the government should control prices in the market. And basically what you have is a backlash to the reforms of the last several years because they're associated with the corruption of the old order. The problem with this is it's a recipe for economic collapse. I'm not worried about the forthcoming election in Egypt nearly as much as I'm worried about the election which will come after that. Because no matter how much debt we forgive, and no matter how much aid we give Egypt and other countries in the region, and also Pakistan, it's not going to be enough to salvage the economy should the governments go down this path. Now, in the Pakistan-specific area, there's certainly very interesting dynamics with regard to the relief from not only the earthquake many years ago, but also the flood, which complicates matters even further by empowering the Islamists at a time when the government is grossly inefficient. Thank you.
Okay, so there's a question. We've got plenty of time. So there's a question here and here. Okay.
Yeah, there. Yeah. One of the things is that...
Just speak up a bit.
Yeah. The Islamic view is a very long-term view. It's not about where we're winning today, tomorrow, next week. It's 5, 10, 15, even 100 years down the track. A lot of the time it seems that if America pulls out of Afghanistan, the same way as when Israel pulled out of Lebanon and then Gaza was seen as a sense of weakness, therefore empowering the opportunity for a long-term win in the end. How do you balance up the Western view of let's get out of there and leave it to their own devices to sort out versus the West the weak?
That's an excellent question. It's actually a point which I'll design whole lectures around when I'm lecturing for the U.S. military. It's the issue of conflicting narratives. And certainly it's true that in the United States, for example, what happened 5 years ago is ancient history, but what's 1,000 miles away is next door. Where in the Middle East and Afghanistan and Pakistan, what happened 1,000 years ago is like a flash in the pan. It's a second ago. And what's 10 kilometers over the hill, it might as well be the ends of the earth. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit on the latter point, but it's an issue. What I worry about as American policymakers and Western policymakers go forward is our inattention to the narratives in Afghanistan. History is important not just to understand another culture and litanies of names and dates. It's important because of the narrative. It's important because it shapes how people think. And so what I'm going to do, if I may, is give you one example of how this has played out rather poorly in Afghanistan. Now, just to show how important narrative is, during our midterm elections in the United States back in 2010, there were lots of commentators in the cable news shows who were talking about President Obama. Some said that President Obama was like Abraham Lincoln because, after all, both came out of Illinois. They rose at an incredibly fast speed, seemingly to come out of left field, and became president. Other commentators said that President Obama is like John F. Kennedy because of the way he can inspire with his rhetoric. Perhaps on Fox News, some commentators said, no, he's like Herbert Hoover. Look what he's doing with the economy. Doesn't matter which side of the American political spectrum you're on. If you go into Afghanistan and talk about Abraham Lincoln, John F. Kennedy, or Herbert Hoover, what's it going to mean to the average Afghan? Absolutely nothing. But if you say it on American television, of course, everyone's going to know what you're talking about. Well, starting back in 2006, I've done a lot of work on engagement, diplomatic engagement with the Taliban. The United States met with the Taliban, for example, on more than 36 occasions between 1995 and the year 2000. I'm not even talking about the current rounds. The British, however, back in 2006, when the insurgency really got bad, decided, look, we know about how to settle this. After all, we fought a terrorist insurgency ourselves. And we had to deal with the Irish Republican Army. And they were putting bombs in pubs in London. They were shooting police officers in Belfast. And what we did, no matter how difficult it was to bite our lower lip and think of the Queen, sit down, and negotiate with them. And therefore, we should do this with the Taliban. Because as painful as it might seem, it really is the only way forward. It worked with the Irish Republican Army, therefore it will work with us. Now, if you go into Afghanistan and talk about the Irish Republican Army, that doesn't mean much either. What means something to Afghans? The First Anglo-Afghan War. It's a story that all Afghans know about. And the British, in pursuit of informal empire to defend India's flank during the Great Game, got involved in a succession struggle between Dost Muhammad and Shah Shuja. They exiled Dost Muhammad to India. They put Shah Shuja on the throne of Kabul. Shah Shuja said he would watch their flank. Well, what basically happened here was an insurgency reigned. The British only wanted informal empire. They didn't want to be bogged down. And so they had 4,500 troops, which at that point in time equaled 16,000 men, women, and children in the cantonment. They went into negotiations with Muhammad Akbar Khan, Dost Muhammad's son, in order to end this insurgency. And what Muhammad Akbar Khan said was, the problem is you're in Kabul. We will agree to keep Shah Shuja on the throne, but we want you to withdraw to Jalalabad. General Elphinstone said, fine, not a problem. And he went down into the valley, and he was immediately set upon. And he basically said, what the heck? And this was the eighth, the insurgent said, well, look, this is the age before telegraph, it's the age before radio. We're sorry, miscommunication. Continue on your way. And you guys know the story. Of the 16,000 British men, women, and children who left Kabul, one made it to Jalalabad, the surgeon William Bryden. If you go into Defense Minister Waddock's office today, you see a painting above his desk. It's a painting of William Bryden stumbling into Jalalabad. But more importantly, when it became known that the British diplomats were negotiating with the Taliban back in 2006, Mullah Omar got on the radio, and the leader of the Taliban. What did he say? He broadcast, I am Dost Muhammad, and Hamid Karzai is Shah Shuja. And this is a narrative that every single Afghan could understand. I'm not saying that one should never negotiate with the Taliban. I don't believe in it, but one can make the argument, and certainly Hamid Karzai has. But at the same time, it's culturally arrogant to believe that our logic is going to apply to the Afghans. It's against the very foundations of multiculturalism not to recognize how different their thought processes are. And in this case, we fell into a trap in which we were depicted, the British in this case, not only as weak, but basically on the path to the greatest loss in British military history up until the Battle of Singapore in 1942. And what does every Afghan know about the aftermath of this? Pretty soon as the British were slaughtered, so was Shah Shuja and Dost Muhammad returned to the throne. This is why Hamid Karzai declared those British diplomats persona non grata, kicked them out of the country. Narrative matters, and it's something which in Washington, with all our navel gazing, with all our belief that the world revolves around Washington, with all our belief that we can set policy without understanding that other people are playing in the sandbox, it's a recipe for disaster. I'm sorry to rabbit on for so long on that question, but it is something I'm passionate about.
Question here.
What is the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda?
Question about the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda.
Basically, in short, because I gave such a long-winded answer there, the Muslim Brotherhood is a much broader group made up of various factions. One could argue both about the Muslim Brotherhood and Tablighi Jamaat on the Pakistani Deobandi side, that they have become recruiting grounds from which, once people are in Muslim Brotherhood organizations or Tablighi Jamaat organizations, they can be identified and Al-Qaeda will recruit from that pool. And certainly the Muslim Brotherhood played a major role in the intellectual evolution that has led to Al-Qaeda, but that doesn't mean that, one of the reasons Zawahiri more or less broke from the Muslim Brotherhood is because he didn't think they went far enough.
Okay, so there's a question down there. Yes, I have something.
So
thank you very much. In the Swat Valley, the...
Ida, just speak up a bit. We're trying to catch up here. Yeah.
In the Swat Valley...
Don't stand up.
some of the first actions of the Taliban involved the oppression of women. What do you think, what is it about the ideology of the jihadists and the Islamists which makes oppression of women such an important pillar?
This is about the oppression of women in the Swat Valley. Yeah.
Well, first of all, I can say definitively, I too am also against the oppression of women. That said, I don't know the answer to that. What I am much more concerned about are two points. One, why it is that so many Western feminists are willing to play games of moral equivalence and turn their back on the oppression of women, because certainly... Just a personal story. I mean, I was in Mazar-e Sharif, Afghanistan in 1997, lecturing at the University of Balkh, which at that point in time, because of the Taliban advance through Herat, through Kabul, was the only university that was teaching women. And certainly those women were valued every opportunity for education that they received, because they could no longer take it for granted. I was actually in Mazar-e Sharif when the Taliban attacked and had to flee. And so I can say that I was among the last people to teach Afghan women before 9/11, at least to teach openly. The other issue, which I worry about, is a tendency in the West to conflate now the ideology of the Taliban with the ideology of both the Pashtun and the Punjabis. Before Richard Holbrooke passed away, I was actually in an office in Kabul. And when I go to Afghanistan, my wife was working there for 6 months, so I was just going as a spouse. I wasn't going with the military. I wasn't going with the State Department, so I didn't have any restrictions on my travel, and I wasn't inside the bubble. When I would, and I would go and have tea with various Afghan officials, many of whom I've known from the past through various capacities, and one of them showed me an email from Richard Holbrooke, in which Richard Holbrooke was trying to say that the Time magazine cover, which depicted a woman with her nose cut off, was unfair because that's just Pashtun culture. And the people this accepted the upset the most were the Pashtun, who said, "How dare you associate our culture with these extremists?" 100 years ago, 50 years ago, just 30 years ago, we weren't going around cutting off women's noses, and that we shouldn't legitimize this ideology. What I'm afraid, part and parcel of the efforts to engage and negotiate with the Taliban, would be a de facto acceptance by some of our diplomats that somehow this is okay, and it's not. But I really don't know the answer to your question about how they can convince themselves that the oppression of women is okay, and I don't see how they can convince themselves that the women are just separate but different, separate but equal.
So there's a question here and here and here. Better be quick. Oh, down the back too. Yes?
I'll be quick too.
A word or two about the ISI and US-Pakistan relations.
Question about the ISI and U.S.-Pakistan relations.
The Inter-Services Intelligence, the ISI, of course, is Pakistan's intelligence agency. I'm glad for two things. One is that when Osama bin Laden was killed, he was killed not in the mountains along the border, but in Abbottabad, basically right within sight of Pakistan's equivalent of West Point. Because it really meant, no matter what our diplomats say, we no longer trust the ISI. The ISI, however, are strict realists. While I was doing my book research on engagement with rogue regimes, the Pakistanis won't be happy with this, but I count Pakistan as a rogue regime, specifically because of the ISI. And I was interviewing former heads of the ISI and former officials, and one whom I met was Asad Durrani, who was the head of the ISI from 1989 to 1992, and he basically made the argument that the biggest mistake the Pakistanis made was when President Musharraf said to George W. Bush, "We will be your allies in this war against terrorism. We will support you. We are with you. We are not with the other side." Because what the ISI explained very collegially is that the Americans constantly embrace Pakistan when we need them, which is true, and then we dump them like a hot potato as soon as we don't need them. We sanctioned them up until 1979 when the Soviets invaded, lifted our sanctions, shipped arms, money, and so forth, and then sanctioned them again in 1989, only lifting the sanctions in 2001. And so what the ISI will say is, given our own national interest, we need to extort as much money from you as possible right now, knowing that you're going to be gone tomorrow. At the same time, this goes into the other issue of multiculturalism. Pakistan is an artificial country. And Pakistan itself, the name is an anagram. P stands for Punjab, A stands for Afghan, K stands for Kashmir, I stands for Indus, and so on. And it's also a pun. Pak, of course, means pure, land of the pure. Well, it's formed to be a state for Muslims, a land of the pure. But at the same time, they've always had an ethnic difficulty, whether it was the Pashtunistan crises in the 1950s and early 1960s, whether it's the Baluchi crisis, which has extended through their whole history. And those were both irritants. But when Bangladesh succeeded in 1971, that shook Pakistan to the core, because what it meant was that ethnic nationalism could tear this country apart. Therefore, we also need to recognize, and that's when the ISI and the Pakistani military really began to Islamize society as the glue to hold everything together. We have to recognize that Pakistan and the United States and the West in general have very different threat perceptions, which are rooted in their history, and we can't simply explain it away over cocktails. The ISI might be operating in the background, but it's operating for a very specific purpose, which runs counter to our interests, and frankly, it will always run counter to our interests. There's an interesting debate in Washington now about perhaps whether the ISI should be designated a terrorist group.
Okay, so we're going to go here, here, down the back, and finish up here. Okay, got to be quick. Yep.
You mentioned introducing Indian forces into Afghanistan. Are you serious?
The Indians already have a very great interest there. There's a reason why the Indian consulate has been blown up in Jalalabad and the Indian embassy has been blown up in Kabul. What I would argue is, this is how I'm approaching the problem. Yes, I am serious. This is how I'm approaching the problem. The problem isn't a desire for perpetual war. God forbid, we don't want that. And the problem is leaving a vacuum. Given the constraints on our own society, I don't believe we should withdraw and leave a vacuum. But I'm curious, in whose interest is it to ensure that Afghanistan doesn't again become a training ground for Harakat-e Mujahideen or Lashkar-e-Taiba and so forth? Indian intelligence is running all around Afghanistan. Perhaps the Afghans could have some... and the Afghan-Indian relationship is actually quite strong, given the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So it's one of those issues which, as India is a rising power, as India grows more concerned about China and Pakistan, is a serious topic for discussion. The last thing we should do, though, is simply, and the Indians certainly aren't there yet, but, certainly aren't there diplomatically in acceptance of such things. But the fact of the matter is, we need to come up with a strategy which avoids a vacuum at the same time, if we want to go, allows us to go, or at least rely on other forces. NATO's really not doing much. The Germans don't fight. I'm saying this on television, they're a waste of space. They sit around and they play foosball. The Danes do a lot of fighting. The Australian Special Forces do a lot of fighting and so forth. But many of the contingents who are in there symbolically. The Indians have a much more realistic interest in not seeing Afghanistan fall to Pakistani influence.
And so we go here down the back and over here.
In your perspective on terrorism, are you not forgetting a lot of history in the sense that Israel, in the Levant affair, was attacking American installations in Egypt with the deliberate intention of pretending that they were Egyptians. In the case of the USS Liberty, it's very hard to believe that that was not a deliberate attack on an American ship, virtually unarmed in broad daylight.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time. Go on.
I would basically respond to that.
Extrajudicial assassination And someone in Guantanamo Bay for 10 years without a charge even having been made.
Now hang on, so there's an allegation about Israel as a country that attacked the United States.
And two countries as ex-terrorists.
Okay. We can have a lot of time.
Very, very quickly. There's been so many investigations about the USS Liberty, and there's always a tendency for some people not to accept the outcome of the investigation. Some people also believe... you asked the question, I'm answering the question. Some people believe that 9/11 was an inside job. There's always a role of conspiracy theories. With regard to Guantanamo Bay, we can learn a lot from Guantanamo Bay by the fact that President Obama has made a near complete reverse on the issue from his first executive order, which was to close it down. The fact of the matter is, the Geneva Conventions don't apply to everyone equally. There's a four-part test within them, and if you want full rights, you have to wear uniforms. You can't fire on crowds from civilian installations and so forth. If you try to extend Geneva Conventions to everyone equally, regardless of whether they abide by the laws of war, then what you are doing is incentivizing people to violate the laws of war. Therefore, I would agree, and I think the death of Osama bin Laden justifies this, that Guantanamo Bay isn't necessarily a bad idea. At the very least, these guys don't deserve the protection of the American Constitution, and they, by law, don't qualify for the full protection of the Geneva Conventions. They qualify for limited protection, which is why the International Committee of the Red Cross is there. And if other countries would take them in, fine. We'd be glad to get rid of them.
This question right off the bat. We've got to be quick.
Very illuminating. I feel like I'm going to leave you a little depressed, I'm afraid, just quickly, you've given us a whole lot of reasons why none of this is working. And yet, you've not had anything positive to say in terms of there are solutions. Do you have any idea of any solutions that could possibly work in this scenario?
The suggestion is you've been a bit too pessimistic and haven't come up with any solutions.
Okay. In short, the answer to that is we have to pay attention to momentum to not cede ground to the other side. When you cede ground to the other side, then you have soft support for some of these terrorist groups. The people that will just join in because they think they have to, the other guy's a strong horse, they need to attach themselves to it for their own survival. So the first thing you need to do is have positive momentum in your favor. Then what you do, and this is what the whole counterinsurgency strategy is provide some development once there's security in order to provide the basis for jobs and so forth. And this is why we're not just focused on the construction of the Afghan National Army, but also on creating some sort of Afghan government which can represent all the people. And then the last thing you do with the unrepentant ideologues is frankly kill them if you can't co-opt them.
Final question, Stuart.
The 2012 presidential race, President Obama looks somewhat vulnerable because of the American economy. That means the Republican Party in play. The Republican Party made up of many different strands. Do you think that the Tea Party is making the Republicans more isolationist? And who are the neoconservatives supporting in the Republican race?
A couple different issues. What makes Obama stronger than I think some people give him credit for is the fact that unlike Jimmy Carter with Ted Kennedy and unlike George H.W. Bush with Pat Buchanan, he's not facing a primary challenge. So that bolsters President Obama's strength. With regard to the Tea Party or with regard to neocons, they're not Borg. Everyone has an individual opinion, and I'm not sure whether there is a consensus. I mean, certainly I'm oftentimes considered a neocon, and I'm considered to go into deep, dark discussions with Richard Perle. The only problem is I haven't seen the guy in 7 years. And certainly no one tells me what to think, which is why some people are mad at me for suggesting that I thought General Petraeus was a very bad choice to run the CIA and didn't do a good job as a general. So ultimately, what we're seeing is an election around domestic issues. What I'm concerned about, and I would say what, if you had to generalize, what the so-called neoconservatives are worried about is the growing tendency of isolationism among some of the Democrats, and many of the Republicans. The Tea Party itself, what defines them is the economic conservatism. Where they differ is with regard to whether or not they believe in a robust defense policy. And on that, there's no consensus.
Michael, we could go on all night, but we won't. So many thanks.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief because we're right on time. Michael Rubin promised us a lively discussion period, which we had, so thanks for that. Thanks for all your contributions, and it's great to have you here from the American Enterprise Institute with the support here of AJEC tonight to come along and talk to us about the war on terrorism. It was a very enlightening and lively discussion, and I'm sure you'll be back again in the future, but until then, well done and thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.